In effect, during those years, Charlie Schnabel came to operate as a virtual second Charlie Wilson. The result was to substantially enhance Wilson's ability to influence events. During this period, the real Charlie Wilson would take the high road as the patron and defender of the CIA's Afghan program. Schnabel, meanwhile, as the congressman's representative, moved about as the undercover bomb thrower, organizing the Andeyeva Gordon Humphrey-style crazies who saw the agency as the enemy. Schnabel himself had come to see the agency as the problem and his boss as an apologist of sorts. But he forgave Wilson this sin because the two of them were playing a kind of good cop, bad cop routine. Without any direct commission, Schnabel was soon operating along the fringes, helping to menace bureaucrats, including some at the CIA, and stirring the pot for the Mooj in ways that Wilson felt he could not afford to do openly. In a sense, he became the dark side of Charlie Wilson, free to operate, but with the implicit understanding that if he got in trouble, he was on his own. The way he got to the front was by wrangling seats on the Pentagon's humanitarian aid flights to Pakistan. Inevitably, in those early years, before the prohibitions on the CIA's support program were lifted, Schnabel could be counted on to be overloaded with contraband for the Mujahideen. On one of his first flights, it was long-range sights for sniper rifles. John McMahon wouldn't let the agency give them to the Mujahideen out of fear that Congress might accuse the CIA of supporting assassination efforts. Schnabel had gotten his rich Texas friends to put up the money for the telescopic sights, and, as was his custom, he told Wilson about his smuggling exploits only after the fact. The old Texas politician always greased his way with charming stories and gifts for everyone on every end, captured Soviet war trinkets for the American officials who manned the humanitarian aid flights, and American military items or congressional pens and seals for the Pakistani ISI agents waiting at the airfield. They looked the other way because he was such a charmer, because he was speaking in Congressman Wilson's name, and because Schnabel would do such things as get their children scholarships to Texas universities, or visas, or medical care through the burgeoning programs that would be opened up in the coming years. As Schnabel got deeper and deeper into the war, he began crossing lines further and further into no man's land. There would be live ammunition strewn about his small office, Makarov pistols, AK-47s, and an RPG grenade launcher under his bed at home, and down in the congressional storeroom, so many rugs and fur coats from Pakistan that it resembled a small market. But it was his love of the Afghan people that burned deepest in Schnabel's sensibilities. In the scrapbooks he keeps are scores of photographic portraits of different Mujahideen. All those faces of old men and young boys, faces of noble warriors wearing turbans and chitrali hats. "You don't see much ferocity in the eyes of a Mujahideen," he explains, paging through the books. "Rather, it's the steady, calm, I'm going to get you look. They would tell me, 'We won't stop till the blood is flowing in the streets of Moscow.' They'd say it as a matter of fact, because God is on our side and Allah will prevail, but we are willing to fight to the last man." And it was no bullshit. They all grew up that way. They grew up as hunters. Soon after falling in love with the Mujahideen, Schnabel dressed himself up in their clothes and went off with them on operations, in violation of the strict embassy ban on any U.S. officials crossing the border. Inside Afghanistan, he would discover the wonder of Nazwar, the opiated snuff that the Afghans put under their tongues for inspiration. They would come to call him Nazwar Charlie, and back in Washington one emotional night, he would even go so far as to convert to Islam, taking the name Abdullah. All of this Schnabel did very much on his own, but in the eyes of everyone he dealt with, he was always operating in Charlie Wilson's name. And what made it possible for him to operate so effectively in what was supposed to be the CIA's arena had nothing to do with the U.S. spy agency. It was, rather, his relationship to a seemingly innocent humanitarian aid program run by the Agency for International Development, AID. In large measure, because of the two Charlies, this seemingly innocent program would be transformed into an indispensable second front in the CIA's Afghan war. The State Department official initially responsible for setting up this effort, known as the Cross-Border Humanitarian Aid Program, was Assistant Secretary of State Gerald Hellman. As he tells the story, by early 1985, Afghanistan had suddenly become a hot program in the national security bureaucracies. The conservative revolution was in full swing. Ronald Reagan had just won re-election by a landslide, and the State Department did not want to look as if it were failing to support the Reagan Doctrine, which called for U.S. support of anti-communist guerrillas. State first sensed an opportunity when the tough old veteran U.S. ambassador to Pakistan at this time, Dean Hinton, met with Hellman and began to urge action to counter a crisis that he saw developing on the Afghan border. Hinton was one of the handful of career diplomats who, during the Cold War, always seemed to be posted in spots where the CIA was active. In 1984, before going out to Pakistan, Hinton had talked to all the experts and found no one who thought there was any chance whatsoever of pushing the Red Army out of Afghanistan. But as the CIA funding mushroomed that fall, so did Hinton's enthusiasm for the operation. "For the first time, we were playing offense instead of defense," he explains. He was unnerved, however, by a series of intelligence reports that concluded that the Soviets were laying waste to a huge strip of land between the Pakistani border and their major garrisons and cities in Afghanistan. Villages were being bombed, irrigation canals destroyed, livestock slaughtered, crops burned, and civilians murdered, tortured, and forced to flee the country. If this were permitted to continue, it was argued, the war would be lost before the new military assistance could have an impact. Guerrillas simply couldn't wander on foot across vast, uninhabitable areas. Famine and disease were said to be moving at a terrifying pace. As important as anything else was the total absence of any medical care. If this continued, the entire military program would be in jeopardy. Hinton warned Hellman that something had to be done to stop the flow of refugees and keep the Afghans in their villages as sources of support for the warriors. He used the term genocide to describe the war policy the Red Army was pursuing over the border. Hellman was not exactly a daring official. Diplomats are good at sensing which way the political winds are blowing, and the leadership of the department had already taken note of the fact that Congress was not just smiling on the CIA's Afghan program. It was hurling money at the problem and browbeating the administration to do more. Specifically, the Senate department's leaders noted that Congress, through Charlie Wilson's Ehrlichon bill, had earmarked money to provide humanitarian aid to the Mujahideen. After listening to Hinton's warnings, Hellman decided to endorse the veteran diplomat's proposal that the State Department contribute to the war effort by starting a humanitarian aid program under its banner. Thus was born the Cross-Border Humanitarian Aid Program. It was initially conceived as a modest program to smuggle food and some medical care across the border, a total of $6 million for 1985. The State Department considered the program to be highly provocative, since it would be the first U.S. effort to openly provide aid to the Mujahideen in the war zone. In truth, very little could be done with $6 million. To complicate matters, the Agency for International Development, which was assigned the task, had little interest in running a program that sounded a lot like a CIA operation. During Vietnam, AID had gotten burned rather badly for providing cover to CIA operatives and for running programs that were very much part of the CIA's efforts. As Hellman explains the dilemma, "We were violating a lot of ground rules that said you shouldn't interfere in the private affairs of another country and certainly should not be operating covertly against another country's will." As a result, the AID leadership would have preferred to have nothing to do with this program. They initially planned only to provide the Pakistanis with humanitarian goods and let them distribute the material to the Afghans. And had it not been for Charlie Wilson, the program almost certainly would have remained small, cautious, and not particularly worthy of comment. But the cross-border program happened to come online just as Wilson had decided to use his appropriations muscle to fund an effort devised by a California doctor, a friend of Charles Fawcett's, to train and send cadres of combat medics into Afghanistan. This zealous figure, Dr. Bob Simon, had already enlisted 100 American volunteers, doctors and nurses, a third of them from Texas. They were to teach the Afghans themselves how to care for their wounded and ill. His ambitions went beyond simple battlefield medicine. He wanted to use this American volunteer effort to focus world attention on the atrocities being committed by the Red Army. As far as Wilson was concerned, this was precisely what the cross-border program should support. The idea of encouraging, much less openly funding, Americans to enter the CIA's proxy war was just about the last thing State and AID wanted to permit. The task of explaining to Wilson why it was not going to be possible to fund his doctor was given to Assistant Secretary Gerald Hellman. And for Charlie Schnabel, who had just joined Wilson's office, the experience of witnessing what happened to the veteran diplomat was an eye-opening introduction into the kind of leverage he would later put to use as Wilson's surrogate. Hellman was solicitous with Wilson. He said the State Department was indebted to the congressman for his role in helping launch the program. Then he explained that, as Wilson could well understand, there were national security concerns that demanded certain restraints in the kinds of support that the United States could provide. Chief among those was an absolute prohibition on any Americans crossing the border. "It's too risky to expose Americans to danger and perhaps cause them to be taken hostage," he said. To this day, Hellman is amazed at Wilson's response. "Hell, that's exactly what I'm aiming for. I want to use American doctors as bait, so they'll be captured and force our chicken-shit government to give the Mooj an anti-aircraft cannon that will take care of the Hind Mi-24 helicopter." Wilson remembers a somewhat tamer response, but acknowledges that he made it clear that if American doctors wanted to go into the war zone, that was their privilege. Whatever his actual words, they were enough to startle the diplomat. "I had to pinch myself," remembers Hellman. "I couldn't figure out if he was pulling my leg. No one in his right mind would want that, but he said this in a room full of people."